Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. This is Shadow War, China and the West. April 1st, 2001, somewhere over the South China Sea. A spy plane, an American EP-3 propeller aircraft with a crew of 24, was heading back to base on the Japanese island of Okinawa after an intelligence-gathering mission.
It was a converted airliner, four-engine prop. Nothing too fancy, but the gear was pretty cool inside.
Shane Osborne, the pilot, was just 26 years old at the time. Pretty young to be at the centre of a crisis which engulfed both Washington and Beijing. Chinese Navy jets had been regularly buzzing the EP-3 flights.
One's right there, 10 o'clock. You're going to pass in front of us.
Right in front of us.
One Chinese pilot was getting uncomfortably close.
It's too close. I agree.
He's very, very close.
Oh, yeah.
Probably 20 feet from our wingtip.
Then disaster struck.
He came in and approached us too fast.
Okay, he's coming in underneath you.
He was underneath us, and that's when he came and rammed into our left wing. My far left engine cut his fuselage in half. His tail broke apart. Then his nose broke apart and impacted the nose of my aircraft as we flipped inverted, tearing the nose off. So next thing I know, I'm staring up at the South China Sea and we're in an inverted dive with no nose, explosive decompression, and severe problems. So we fell inverted for over 2 miles. Two of our four engines were damaged. My tail was damaged. My nose was gone. My airspeed indication was gone. I later lost my altitude indication. And I knew we were going to need to land. We weren't going to make it all the way back 2.5, 3 hours. The plane wasn't going to hold together that long.
We'll be returning to the fate of that EP-3 spinning out of control later. That collision caused a crisis in 2001, but not a war. What if it happened today? There are still close calls in the air, and relations between the West and China are in a far more difficult, even dangerous place. I'm Gordon Carrera, and I'll be looking at the ways both sides, like those two planes in the South China skies, collide, and whether the risks are growing and could even lead to war.
We recognise China poses a systemic challenge to our values and interests.
MI5 and the FBI came together in an unprecedented joint statement to say that China was our biggest security threat.
What they are is an epoch-defining challenge for our country.
I've spent 20 years covering national security and have listened to the drumbeat of warnings about the threat from China grow steadily. So are the fears well-founded? And if so, has the West and its leaders been slow to wake up? We'll be delving into the recent history of espionage and surveillance, political interference and free speech, asking what is the right way for the West to deal with China's rise and growing assertiveness. That fanfare composed by the Chinese was called Moment of Victory. We're in 1997 and Hong Kong is being handed back from British colonial rule to China.
The Union flag and the Hong Kong flag will now be lowered.
The handover of Hong Kong signalled the end of a century and a half of British rule, but it also brought to an end a top-secret operation which had been running through the territory. Set up as an escape route after the Tiananmen Square massacre 8 years earlier, its codename was Yellowbird. Let's start, if we're all recording.
Yes, sir. My name is Yan Xiong. In 1989, when I was a senior law school student, we cried for a political reform that is the famous Tiananmen Square demonstration. I was one of the students leading that movement as a student leader.
The troops have been firing indiscriminately, but still, there are thousands of people on the streets who will not move back.
Inside China, the CCP, China's Communist Party, censors all mention of events at Tiananmen Square when the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, opened fire on students protesting for democracy.
My name is Wang Chaohua. That's to say surname first in Chinese order. I got involved in the student protest in spring 1989, ended up on the most wanted list issued by the government. So I went to hiding for more than half a year.
Meanwhile, Yan was one of the first students arrested. He spent 19 months in jail. Then, in the spring of 1991, he travelled to the south, where he was given a business card for what turned out to be a Hong Kong-based pro-democracy group. Eventually, he was instructed to head to the coast, where he was put onto a boat, destination Hong Kong. A year before, Chaohua Wang had a similar cloak-and-dagger journey south.
I was like a parcel, moved from one to another, spending one night here, spending another night here, and then another night, I was left alone at a beach. So a boat came.
Did you know who had organised to get you out and who had funded to get you out on Yellowbird?
Not beforehand and not thereafter for many years.
Nigel Inkster, who eventually rose to become deputy head of MI6, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, was in Hong Kong in the run-up to the handover.
Were you aware of Operation Yellowbird?
Yes.
Were you involved? Can you say anything about it?
I was not involved. This was not something that Western intelligence services were involved in.
After his arrival in Hong Kong, Yan was given a good meal, but put in a detention centre to keep his presence in the colony secret.
After 1 week, the England gentleman called me out, go to his office, and he's so nice, and he completed the paperwork for me. So he said, hey, it's better for you to go to America, not England. Then I take the plane, landed in Los Angeles, June 16.
And the national flag of the People's Republic of China and the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region flag will be raised.
The decision to hand the colony back had been made before Tiananmen Square. In its aftermath in the 1990s, a battle raged among British officials. How far should the West cooperate with China, and how far should it confront it? Chris Patten was the last British governor of Hong Kong.
I had to, I think, recognise that my main responsibility was to try to give people in Hong Kong the best chance of continuing to live in freedom and prosperity, and to do so after 1997.
When you were there on that rainy night at the handover, did you feel job well done? Did you feel anxiety about what might happen? Did you feel relief at getting out?
Well, I felt huge sadness at leaving so many really good friends. I sort of thought that over the years we could have done better, but that we hadn't done a bad job. We'd created a sort of infrastructure, like scaffolding, which people could climb and make lives better for themselves, and that there was a reasonable shot of it surviving.
How long would it survive? In the years after, Britain and its Western allies would get distracted by issues like the war on terror, Iraq and Afghanistan. It was high up in northern India that the first signs of what would become a global threat in cyberspace began to appear as Tibetan dissidents became victims of cyber attacks.
Where are you, first of all, tell us?
I'm on a ridge in McLeod Ganj, overlooking the valley where the Tibetan government exile is. Immediately opposite, on the next ridge, is the Dalai Lama's residence and private office.
Greg Walton is a cyber sleuth. Since the 1990s, he's worked with Tibetans in exile, based in Dharamsala in northern India. Their leader, the Dalai Lama, fled from Tibet in the 1950s after China took over.
There was a moment in September of 2002 when a group of us who were monitoring some of the systems, either in person or remotely, started to say, hang on, there's a pattern here. Let's start collecting and cataloguing these viruses, as we called them at the time.
Tibetan activists were receiving emails supposedly from other Tibetans with documents to open. They contain malicious software which could spy on their machines. Activists crossing into Tibet were also being arrested, with Chinese police confronting them with their online chats. In London, the first ever attempts to target UK government systems were beginning, including using emails linked to Tibet. The fact this came from China would be kept secret for years. Diplomatic communications were particularly important to Beijing, as it sought to curb the Dalai Lama's contacts with world leaders.
China's crackdown in Tibet is intensifying. The Chinese authorities in the capital Lhasa have announced the arrest of 24 people accused of involvement in recent riots.
This may be the BBC confrontation that led to the worst violence here in two decades.
In 2008, there were protests inside Tibet against Chinese government rule. They also spread to neighbouring countries. Greg was back in Dharamsala, where he saw a spike in attempts to target them online. Greg and a colleague began investigating, looking at the internet traffic in the Dalai Lama's office.
We did talk to people who had seen their mouse cursor moving and trembling around.
People have seen their mouse doing things without them touching it. The cursor on the screen moving.
Exactly. Yes, in real time we were watching sensitive documents being exfiltrated to a server in Hainan Island.
Which is in China. Yeah.
That's right. It's a large naval base in on an island in southern China.
Yeah, which is thought to be home to one of the Chinese military's intelligence directorates, which deals with cyber issues. I think that's long been the thought. I've lost the video for a second. Can you hear us? Interesting. Literally, just as we started talking about Hainan and China...
That is
genuinely weird. Look, I'm not normally conspiratorially minded, but Greg is frozen on screen.
So just as we started discussing Chinese intelligence, we were mysteriously cut off.
Oh, interesting.
After a few minutes, we did manage to reconnect.
Recording in progress.
Hi, Greg.
Hello.
You're back. That felt a touch suspicious to me. Or was it just pure coincidence?
No, we joke about that and have done for some years.
So where does this story fit into the bigger picture of cyber attacks and China's Communist Party? Unbeknownst to them, the Tibetans were at the dawn of a threat that has since gone global, but few were paying attention at the time.
In a way, the Tibetans and others are serving as a sort of digital canary in the coal mine, as it were. If people had been closely tracking what the Tibetans were saying in terms of threats that they were seeing in 2002, we could have been better prepared.
The first time I remember covering a cyber attack which made headline news was in early 2010. The American tech giant Google revealed it had been hacked. Known as Operation Aurora, the attack was traced back to Chinese hackers.
China is one of those countries suffering most hacker attacks.
In 2013, I sat down in Beijing's foreign ministry with China's top cyber official.
So other countries are saying that your state is sponsoring these attacks, but you're saying you're the victim of hacker attacks.
Right.
On one level, that's true. Let's not pretend the West doesn't spy on China. It does so on a massive scale. And cyberspace is one place where the shadow war between China and the West has played out. But China's cyber spying gives us an insight into what critics say Beijing wants and fears. Targeting Tibetans and other dissidents signals that the first priority for the Chinese Communist Party is to silence critics, those who could challenge its grip at home, but also to control the narrative abroad, an instinct which has only grown stronger under President Xi Jinping, who took over in 2012, according to Nigel Inkster, formerly of MI6.
Xi Jinping wants a situation in which China is basically no longer dependent on the West or any other country for its economic prosperity or security, where other countries are, however, dependent upon China and are effectively occupying a kind of client status. I mean, I think, you know, we would find ourselves living in a state that would not presume to challenge China's political system or values, you know, that people like you would be carted off to the gulag.
Thanks, Nigel.
For presuming to do so.
But asking difficult
exactly,
questions.
Yes. Okay. And we would simply accept a relationship, an economic relationship, a, you know, security relationship that was slanted in Beijing's favour.
And that suggests economically dependent, but also countries not willing to challenge, if you like, the Communist Party's legitimacy or raise issues which are difficult for the Communist Party.
Exactly, yeah.
Tiananmen, Tibet,
that's right.
Taiwan, those kind of issues.
Those things would simply go away. As a great power, China would not need to heed the restrictions of customary international law.
We'll be getting a view from inside China later. It's October 2023, and I'm in California for an unusual event chaired by former US National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice.
Well, good morning and welcome. This is a very, very special and historic moment. And we have together, at least for the first time publicly, the intelligence chiefs of what's called the Five Eyes. And
these Western spy chiefs had never been seen together before.
Obviously, the Five Eyes being the United States, Australia, New Zealand, the UK and Canada.
The location in California's Silicon Valley was no accident. The security chiefs had gathered to warn that China was stealing technology.
Gordon Carrera from the BBC. Could I ask each of the Five Eyes whether they've seen evidence that the technology that China has stolen has been weaponized in any way, particularly for interference activities or repression activities, in terms of data being stolen?
The Chinese government has stolen more of Americans' personal and corporate data than every other nation, big or small, combined.
Stealing commercial secrets is as old as the hills. Go back far enough and you'll find Britain stealing the secrets of tea from China. But the Five Eyes spy chiefs felt not enough attention had been paid to their warnings in the past few years about Beijing targeting technology, perhaps because politicians and businesses wanted access to China's growing market. So going public was about turning up the volume another notch.
For an organisation like MI5, we're no longer just seeing our state adversaries focused on stealing government secrets or military or nuclear secrets.
I sat down in California with Ken McCallum, the head of MI5, Britain's security service.
But focused on a much, much wider range of companies and researchers across our economy as a whole, focused on academic research, on small startup companies that have some funky new innovation or piece of technology that they are developing. If you're working today at the cutting edge of technology, then geopolitics is interested in you, even if you're not interested in geopolitics.
What's at stake then if companies and countries don't focus on this issue? What are the risks to the UK and to its allies?
Countries that lead the way on these very powerful emerging technologies will, over the next few years, come to wield very immense amounts of power over the future direction of our globe. But at the individual company level, what it can mean is that the precious assets that you have worked so hard to develop through your research, through your innovation, those assets can be stolen from you pretty quickly by ruthless actors backed by states on the other side of the world.
In the 1990s, it had been hoped that globalization and trade would change China, drawing it into the liberal international order. That proved wrong. Especially in recent years, China has created its own model, one in which state-directed economic growth would tighten the grip of the Communist Party at home and extend its influence abroad.
The Chinese government is watching us, observing our movement, our speech, so they know. I don't know how, but they have been getting that data about us. It's not surprising that Chinese students walk out when you speak against Chinese government, Chinese Communist Party.
And you don't think Western governments, Western universities understand this enough at the moment?
There's still lack of knowledge, lack of understanding about how severe it can be. It is going to be.
There is a clash of values, and it's playing out in universities. So is free speech threatened?
That specific week, we invited Congresswoman Elisa Slotkin to speak about her career in public service.
Rizwan Gulnur Mohammed is a Uyghur from Xinjiang in western China. She now lives in New Zealand, but in 2022 she was a Fulbright scholar at America's Cornell University in New York State.
I asked Slotkin why the US and international community has reacted strongly to the Russians' invasion in Ukraine and support them. But when you look at the Uyghur situation, we don't really see that much support and action.
It's thought hundreds of thousands, perhaps a million members of the Uyghur Muslim minority in Xinjiang have been put in detention or re-education camps.
When the congresswoman had like barely begun responding to my question, the Chinese international students in the room stood up to walk out. There was no hesitation. It clearly appeared to me that it is a coordinated and a premeditated initiative.
In this case, 40 or so Chinese students, half the class, walked out all together.
I heard them laughing.
What particularly hurt was that Riz's brother was arrested in 2017 as part of the mass detention of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. She's not been able to speak to him since.
It is intimidating for me. They were trying to shut me up. They don't want to hear any critics about the Chinese Communist Party. They want me to stop talking about it.
From personal experience, when one had one-on-one meetings with students from China, students from China can be just as open and critical-minded as students from anywhere else.
Steve Tsang is Professor of Chinese Studies at London School of Oriental and African Studies.
But when you have a group of them together discussing a politically sensitive subject, then suddenly that liveliness is being replaced by caution or a lot of the time silence.
He says there's a worry that students could report back to the Chinese authorities on what they hear. So how is all of this viewed from China? It's time to hear from Beijing.
When I was a student in Kent, I remember there was very little knowledge among the British about China. There was not much attention paid to China here in UK.
Fu Ying first came to Britain as a graduate student in the mid-1980s. She returned to the UK in 2007 as China's ambassador to London. In 2010, she became Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs and is now at Tsinghua University.
For the Chinese, nationalistic feeling is very strong, especially about the country's painful past. Hong Kong was colonized, so when Hong Kong's sovereignty returned to China, it was a big event. China is still not completely reunited. People feel very strong about national unity. So I don't doubt if the Chinese students feel strong about Hong Kong. But there might be students in Hong Kong who were part of the protest that have different views. But I think it shouldn't be a problem between China and the United Kingdom.
You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. Welcome back to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Gordon Carrera, and this is Shadow War, China and the West. In December 2023, the Hong Kong police offered large rewards for information leading to the arrest of five overseas activists. Simon Cheng was one of them. We spoke to him just after he found out.
I'm still quite shocked at how far they would go after not only me, but even my family members.
Sounds like it was a surprise to you that they would go this far.
Surprise and not surprise. But when what you expect becoming reality, it's still pretty hard to adapt to this.
Now, Hong Kong people are to run Hong Kong. That is the promise, and that is the unshakable destiny.
That was 1997 in the pouring rain at the handover ceremony as Hong Kong was returned to China. Chris Patten was the last British governor of Hong Kong.
To be fair, for 10, maybe a dozen years after 1997, things didn't go too badly in Hong Kong.
According to the agreement signed by Beijing and London and a principle known as One Country, Two Systems, Hong Kong was supposed to retain its own distinctive institutions and liberties, like freedom of speech and assembly, political parties, and an independent judiciary.
There were all sorts of warning signs, but by and large, they didn't really interfere with things. But I do think that changed with Xi Jinping pretty dramatically. And I think it changed because the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party was starting to worry that its control was slipping. Hong Kong represented everything which they thought was an existential threat.
The more the tear gas, the more the defiance. Tens of thousands outside government headquarters.
In 2014, a proposal by Beijing to change Hong Kong's electoral system and restrict who was allowed to stand led to protests, what was called the Umbrella Movement. The following year, China was accused of abducting five Hong Kong booksellers. Then in 2019, the Hong Kong government proposed an extradition bill, which meant local residents could be sent to trial on the mainland for breaking Chinese laws. It sparked a new wave of protests.
These are traumatic days for the people of Hong Kong.
We've been seeing this for months, a row over a government bill, demands for greater democracy, allegations of police brutality.
At the time, Simon Cheng worked as a trade and investment officer for the British consulate in Hong Kong. He felt moved to attend some of the demonstrations.
And I felt very happy that time, many people being together. I felt a deep sense of belonging.
His job regularly took him to the mainland. On the 8th of August 2019, he left Hong Kong for the day to attend a business event in Shenzhen, just over the border.
I finished my business trip in Shenzhen. I took a high-speed rail train to West Kowloon High-Speed Railway Station. I was at the mainland China port. I inserted my ID card and I'm ready to get off the China port and into Hong Kong. I've been stopped there.
Chinese policemen took him to a cell. Over the next 2 weeks, he was interrogated.
There's a chair there, so they would buckle you up. You can't move and you only can sit on that chair. They keep asking me why I've been here and why you joined the protest, who with you joined the protest, and where the British government be behind the protest, etc. The whole situation is very abnormal. It's like a very extrajudicial kidnapping. And when I insist that all the things I have done in Hong Kong is legal, then they would say, it might be legal in Hong Kong, but where are you now?
The police pressed him for a confession.
They forced me to confess that I, firstly, solicited prostitutes, and secondly, betrayal to China.
Simon Cheng was released after 2 weeks. He ended up in Britain. The protests continued for months. Hopes for any compromise disappeared as both sides became increasingly entrenched. They only ended when COVID hit. Steve Sang, originally from Hong Kong, believes the protesters were simply asking for what they'd been promised.
They pushed for more democracy, which in principle were promised by the Sino-British Joint Declaration and the Hong Kong Basic Law. Without understanding the nature of the Communist Party, which is that the Communist Party would never allow that to happen.
British politicians criticised China reneging on the promises made in the joint declaration, which were supposed to last until 2047. It's no surprise the view from Beijing is rather different. Former Chinese diplomat and politician Fu Ying.
What makes the Chinese people feel uncomfortable is that, I want to be candid, is the UK's condescending and high-handed attitude about China's internal affairs. Kind of a reminiscence of its colonial past. The British side likes to mention the Sino-British Joint Declaration is very often mentioned. It's an important document. The Chinese side also sees it's an important document. Sometimes the British talk as if Hong Kong still needs to be administrated by the Joint Declaration. And you can't expect China continue to administrate part of its territory with the Joint Declaration with a foreign country. The British side seems to have difficulties understanding that that's over, that the page is turned. They cannot act as if they still have power on that land.
Yes, sir. My name is Yan Xiang.
Remember Yan? We last heard from him at the start, a Tiananmen Square student leader escaping as part of Operation Yellowbird and finding his way to the United States.
Then I joined the army. I defended the freedom.
Yan became a US Army chaplain for 20 years, even serving in Iraq. But let's pick up his story in 2021, 3 decades after he left China.
After my retirement, I say, I want to serve the freedom. So I want to be a congressman so I can make a good policy, help more people, maybe change the U.S.-China policy. So how can I do a little bit more to help my country, my nation, my people?
But it seems China did not want Yan to shape policy as a congressman. As Yan started campaigning in New York, he noticed odd things happening.
When I go to the crowd, try to make a speech, they block me, they push me, they don't give me the speaker. Actually, every day, they have someone bothering me, against me.
He also spotted strange cars parked outside his home in the early hours of the morning. Then one day, the FBI came calling.
My name is Jason Mort. I'm a special agent with the FBI New York field office. I've been a special agent for approximately 6 years.
The FBI's interest had been piqued in September 2021 when...
we had a private investigator here in the New York area that contacted the FBI and said he was recently approached by a China-based individual who was trying to obtain information on a congressional candidate here in the New York area.
The private investigator agreed to work with the FBI. He'd been contacted over a messaging app by an individual in China called Lin Qiming.
It was very clear the person in the PRC that was perpetrating it identified himself as a former MSS intelligence officer.
Roman Rajovsky is a section chief in the FBI's counterintelligence division. The MSS he's referring to is the Ministry of State Security, and the PRC is the People's Republic of China.
Lin Qiming hired a private investigator and basically said, we don't like this candidate's politics. He's a former Tiananmen Square protester. We don't want to see him elected. And we were recording these conversations between him and the private investigator.
The communications between Lin and the private investigator very quickly escalated in, hey, can you find out something dirty about his past? Can you find out if he had an extramarital affair so we can use that? And then if not, is there a way for you to fabricate that he had an extramarital affair, all with the intent of ruining the victim's election?
And there was even talk about trying to stage an accident.
Yes, that was actually a pivotal moment in the investigation, because up until that point in time that we did not have any indication that the victim's life or safety would be in jeopardy. And it was during one of these phone calls where Lin contacted the private investigator and he talks about beating him and then says that should be a last resort. And then he says a car accident. Is that a possibility?
It seems extraordinary that 30 years after Yan Chong left China, the authorities there were determined to reach into America to stop him running for office, even discussing using violence. The FBI refers to the targeting of critics like Yan as transnational repression. Australia has been at the leading edge among the Five Eyes intelligence alliance of Western countries in warning about political interference.
It was about 2016, 2017, obviously my organisation and others started to noticing things that were not right.
Mike Burgess is the head of Australia's security and intelligence organisation.
We saw in Australia attempts to interfere in our political system. The local government, state government and federal government level, Chinese government would covertly interfere, trying to seek and curry favour with individuals or people who are elected and actually put people in to be elected or support people to get elected. 2 years ago, I gave a public example of this, of the puppeteer and the puppet. So we had a wealthy person, dual citizen, who was funding an individual, and that individual was actually looking to fund people to get selected and elected.
With this political interference, what's your sense of what the agenda is?
They're trying to influence, and sometimes through malign influence, interfere. You know, that might be, we need support because we want to do this on Taiwan and we need to show the Australian Parliament, Australian government supports us on Taiwan. They do that clandestinely. We'd prefer them to come in and have a chat and tell us openly why they need our support and let us make an informed decision.
So what's the view from Beijing? Fu Ying.
It was in Munich. I came across somebody from the United States, U.S. Scholar. We knew each other for a long time, and we chatted about American domestic politics. And he raised the question, the concern that China would interfere in the American elections, general elections. I said, can you give me a reason? Why? Why should China interfere in your elections? Who should China favor? See, China, we are a country which is very sensitive about international interference from any country. So, like we believe what Confucius said, if you don't want something to happen to yourself, you don't do it on others. So we don't interfere in internal affairs of other countries. We draw a very clear red line on that. How to say, we need to be careful about the ulterior motives and people who spread these kind of stories.
Well, the sound you're hearing is the sound that happens when an airplane lands across about 9 airports around the world, and Ginkgo's program works with airlines and airports to attach a device to the lavatory drainage systems.
Matthew McKnight is general manager for biosecurity at the American company Ginkgo Bioworks.
It is as disgusting as it sounds, but we're collecting a small sample of that lavatory from airlines that have flown across the world.
The samples are taken to labs to identify dangerous viruses or bacteria. It's essentially an early warning system or biological radar, useful for spotting things like COVID. It's part of a new world of biological engineering.
What we really think we're on the cusp of in the world is this massive revolution in how we make things, how humans can truly engineer biology for incredible purposes, from obviously medicines to food to new materials.
And this world is subject to intense competition between China and the US. Anna Puglisi used to be America's National Counterintelligence Officer for East Asia and is now at Washington, D.C.'s Georgetown University.
Do we want to be dependent on a strategic competitor at best to develop these technologies? And that's really concerning, especially when an authoritarian government has the bulk of that data and control over that data.
To carry out research, you need genomic data, effectively our genes, our DNA and biological information. So who controls that data is crucial.
And they want to mine you like you're a raw material.
Mike Casey is the director of the U.S. National Counterintelligence and Security Center.
Once they have it, they get to use it for however they want. You are giving away your citizens' data. It can be used to develop cancer drugs that you become reliant on. It can be used to develop weapons that can be used against you. You have no control over that.
He worries, for example, about Chinese companies offering prenatal tests to mothers in Europe.
Should people want to give that data away free to anyone? Probably not. Should you want to give it away free to an authoritarian regime that's shown itself to be, you know, not particularly concerned about privacy or the rights of individuals or how they use that data? I don't think that's an unreasonable thing for people to be concerned about.
Have you seen evidence that data has gone from citizens in the US or the UK or other allied countries to China?
I think the answer to that's yes. I mean, you know, you end up with some concerns. The Chinese government has passed a number of national security laws that mandate that private companies and others cooperate with the government and the Chinese military.
That data, he says, can be used for surveillance.
The classic scenario is somebody's at a protest and they leave behind some genetic material, hairs, whatever. Could the Chinese government, in theory, then track down who all these people were at protest? Yes. Could they identify who their relatives are and go look at them and put pressure on them to stop their cousin from protesting? Certainly.
Chinese companies deny that they pose any security risk, and critics argue this debate is as much about US protectionism for its companies and fear of China's rise in technology as anything else. But Anna Puglisi says a significant problem is that the flow of data is one way.
We assume that they will share things equally and fairly at our peril.
They have outlawed shipping the genetic data out of China to the West. They understand what you can do with this and want to make sure that that's not a problem for them. It's just a problem for us.
This is part of a wider battle. Think of the fears over TikTok and dependency on Chinese companies. And also think of what could be done in the future with all this data using artificial intelligence. Here's Ken McCallum, the head of MI5. I spoke to him recently in California.
Countries who gain significant advantage in AI will have lots of opportunity to get even further ahead. AI has huge opportunities to improve human productivity, to research new medicines. You know, there are so many positive elements that can emerge from AI, but there are also risks, and trying to avoid having anything like the dystopian surveillance state that we know exists in China extending to other parts of the world would feel to me like an important priority.
One's right there. 10 o'clock. Oh, you're going to pass in front of me.
Okay, he's coming in underneath you.
He was underneath us, and that's when he came and rammed into our left wing.
We left Shane Osborne in April 2001 in trouble over the South China Seas.
Next thing I know, I'm staring up at the South China Sea, and we're in an inverted dive with no nose, explosive decompression, and severe problems.
Shane was captain of an American spy plane flying in international airspace off China's coast, collecting radio and radar signals. But one of the Chinese pilots buzzing his propeller plane had got too close. As they tumbled towards the sea, time was running out, but there was a job to do: get rid of the intelligence gear on their plane.
We were in a bad way, so I called for the emergency destruction checklist. The crew in the back did a great job. They were pinned to the floor in this violent inverted maneuver in an aircraft, but they got up, took the emergency exits off, and started throwing the equipment out, destroying it.
The pilot that collided with them crashed into the ocean and died. Shane's only possible destination now was Hainan Island, where those Chinese Navy jets had taken off from. With his plane severely damaged, Shane came in for a fast landing.
And then we were greeted by two armed troop carriers with, Chinese military with AK-47s. They surrounded the airplane. We were surrounded by soldiers with guns, and I knew it was time to shut down. I didn't want anybody getting shot.
This was the new President George W. Bush's first foreign policy crisis.
Our priorities are the prompt and safe return of the crew and the return of the aircraft without further damaging or tampering.
The Chinese accused Shane Osborne of causing the crash which killed their pilot.
They also wanted me to admit wrongdoing.
Right.
That's what they were really trying for, is to get me on film taking some sort of responsibility for the incident, which I clearly wasn't going to do.
Eventually, after 12 days of high-level negotiations, a form of words was agreed between Washington and Beijing.
Good morning. I'm pleased to be able to tell the American people that plans are underway to bring home our 24 American servicemen and women from Hainan Island.
In a carefully crafted letter, the Americans expressed regret for the death of the Chinese pilot and for landing on Hainan without permission, but maintained they'd done nothing wrong. Both sides interpreted what became known as the Letter of Two Sorries in the way that suited them. Neither wanted things to spin out of control. The crisis was resolved without an escalation. But what if it happened today? Tensions have been running high, with more near misses.
A Chinese warplane has fired flares at an Australian helicopter.
After a near miss between an Australian Navy helicopter and a Chinese Air Force plane in the Yellow Sea.
That was very recently in the sea between China and Korea. Just days before the Australian incident, a Chinese vessel fires water cannon at a Filipino Coast Guard ship in the South China Seas.
The Chinese attacks continued for half an hour. This is a familiar ordeal for these Filipino crew members.
Much has changed since 2001. China is stronger and more assertive, and relations with the West more tense. So could all this friction really lead to war? In a rare interview, I asked Sir Richard Moore, the head of Britain's Overseas Intelligence Service, MI6, about whether he saw China as a threat.
China is a major power. It's a great power. And it's a power, furthermore, which aspires to increase its power and influence within the world. And I think ultimately it aspires to displace the United States as the foremost power. It's also run by people who don't share our worldview and who often contest fiercely UK interests, whether that's in the United Kingdom itself or it's overseas.
Do we need to worry about a conflict? I mean, are we heading towards a conflict, do you think, with China?
in these sort of circumstances, in the rather dangerous, contested world we're living in, we should always worry about conflict and we should set ourselves to avoid it, particularly when you have powers that may not always understand each other as well as they should.
We've been looking at points of friction, whether over free speech or economic espionage. They come from tectonic plates shifting, and an important question: who shapes the international order? It's a battle over control of institutions, over values and influence. Professor Steve Tsang.
Under Xi Jinping, China is seeking to change the international order and the international norm, make the world safe for autocracies and autocrats, regrettably at the expense of democracies and human rights. And that, I think, is where the real challenges are.
The view from China, on the other hand, is that the current international system is one the US has created to serve its own interests and values. Ambassador Fu Yin
again. China does not pose a challenge to the American self-claimed dominance. It's the US itself.
She says China isn't trying to impose its system on others, but is seeking a different
world. If US wants to continue to play the leadership of the world, it has to continue to provide to the world. If US keep on telling about doing things only for its own benefit, then how can it have a harmonious relationship with others? So in the future, either it has to accommodate, open up, to be part of the multilateral world, or to withdraw, like the US is trying to do, to become a leader of the smaller group.
You posit this idea that America has to either accommodate or withdraw from trying to set the rules and run the international order in your mind. It clearly believes that it is a danger to live in an international order in which China sets the rules.
China has not made any rule for the world yet. And China proposes that the countries in the world work together to solve problems. I think the U.S. concern of China is out of its own mirrored image. It is afraid that China will do the things it did in the past.
That the U.S. did in the past?
Yeah, yes.
The U.S. is already pushing to decouple or de-risk aspects of its economic ties with China, especially over technology, whether it be electric vehicles, telecoms, or trying to ban TikTok. We shouldn't forget there are many benefits from the West and China cooperating, dealing with challenges like climate change or finding cures for diseases. The Chinese Communist Party is accused of all kinds of nefarious activities, stealing Western technology, political interference, illegal territorial claims, failing to uphold international agreements it signed up to. Chaohua Wang, the Tiananmen Square student leader who fled China, believes what's happening is essentially a conflict about values, one to be fought not militarily, but by promoting people's rights and the rule of law.
All those strong men around the world are watching each other. So if China can do this, maybe we can do it too. I agree that we must have engagement with China. However, economic engagement alone, you would lose out in the future. That's very short-sighted. You must come with other tools to protect yourself, and you'll see in the long run that we will also protect Chinese people.
There have been renewed contacts in recent months between Beijing and Washington. No one wants another incident like Shane Osborne's over the South China Sea, escalating into an accidental conflict. But that doesn't take away the deeper challenge of two sides struggling to work out how they can live with each other. And that means what has sometimes been a shadow war in the last few decades will increasingly move into the open. You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. Shadow War, China and the West was presented by me, Gordon Carrera, and the producer was John Murphy.